Hare Krishna, welcome. You are Monday, March 15 session of this seminar on the philosophy of transcendence, the Bhagavad philosophy, and comparative philosophy. As we go through Krishna's conscious philosophy, inevitably we have to look at other philosophical positions. So yesterday we were speaking of the difference between transcendental consciousness, material consciousness, the original mind, tattva, the tattva state of the mind, and the vritti state, the state in which consciousness is involved with material activities of sense gratification. So I just want to begin by again reading a quotation from Srila Prabhupada, which I think will refresh our memory of much of what was presented yesterday. And then we'll go on from here, from this quotation, into further issues. So Srila Prabhupada writes, "Not only must one come to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness," please note what Prabhupada is saying. It's a given now that one will be is in the stage of pure Krishna consciousness, Srila Prabhupada says, but that's not quite enough. He says, not only must one come to the state of pure Krishna consciousness, but one must also be very careful. Any inattentiveness or carelessness may cause fall down. This fall down is due to false ego. From the status of pure consciousness, the false ego is born of misuse of independence. We cannot argue about why false ego arises from pure consciousness. Factually, there is always this chance that this will happen, and therefore one has to be very careful. False ego is the basic principle for all material activities, which are executed in the modes of material nature. As soon as one deviates from pure Krishna consciousness, he increases his entanglement in material reaction. The entanglement of materialism is the material mind. That's the foundation of all material existence, is the material mind. And from the material mind, the senses and material organs become manifest. This is the direction that we're going to be moving in today's lecture, today's seminar, and we may be still involved in this tomorrow. So now, I just want to, again, yesterday I also drew your attention to this point of inattention and carelessness. I want to also mention that I've heard from a good source, from actually several of my older godbrothers, who heard Srila Prabhupada say this, and this was in the early days of his preaching in New York. And moreover, there is also the same point is made in an old Back to Godhead article. I do not remember, I cannot cite the issue and the year, but I do clearly remember this article. So Srila Prabhupada was speaking about the return to the spiritual world, the experience of going back to Godhead and again coming into the association of the Lord and His devotees. And Srila Prabhupada said that experience is like I'm using my own language because what Srila Prabhupada said, his exact words I can't quote, but as it was explained to me by more than one godbrother, his experience like snapping out of a daydream. You know, we may be in a class and lecture is going on and the mind just drifts off and we're no longer hearing, we're there, but we're no longer hearing the lecture. And the speaker of the lecture may notice And so I've done this, and perhaps Maharaj has done like this. You suddenly ask a question to that person that you notice is facing out a question about what you've just said. And then that brings the person back. He's suddenly back in the class again. Now, he never left the class physically, but his mind was not. He finds himself back in the class, and the speakers look, and all the devotees are looking at him. So Srila Prabhupada said the return to the spiritual world, the experience is something like that. Coming out of a state of inattention, which in terms of spiritual time, and yesterday I told you there is certainly spiritual time. So in terms of spiritual time, it is like a moment of what we call spacing out. So it's a moment of that time, but a moment of transcendental time can be ages and ages and ages, can be universal manifestations upon universal manifestations, creation, maintenance, destruction of many, many universes, many, many breaths of Mahavishnu. So, now, this is of course the we know Srila Prabhupada explained in this way, in clear language, that the living entity was originally with Krishna, and in a relationship with Krishna. And as, you know, the big controversy is about this falling down. So we tried to lay that to rest yesterday by showing it is a fall of consciousness. But actually we remain within the Vishnu Maya, the same energy of the Lord. Mama ayavamsa jiva loke, the jiva is always part and parcel of Krishna. So the actual relationship with Krishna, just like when one is in the class, one is still in the class. One is not gone somewhere else, many miles away. But the mind is, and Prabhupada also said, one can be sitting in the temple with the other devotees, say during japa period. But if the mind wanders, if the mind goes out, then one is not actually in the temple anymore. Although the body is there. So this has caused some, you know, controversy through the years. There have been objections raised to this, and sometimes the objections are fortified by quotations from other acharyas. So it's not the purpose of the seminar to go into that. That would be perhaps a whole other seminar. But inevitably, if there's a seminar in philosophy, this question always comes up. Even if I don't talk about it, someone's going to raise their hand and ask. So I thought I should address to some extent this issue. So regarding statements of previous acharyas, actually a couple of years ago, a godbrother raised this point with me in an email. There is a book, translation of Brahmana O Vaishnava, is that it in Bengali, by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, which is in English Brahmana and Vaishnava. And so this godbrother was pointing out to me on page 139 of that book, there is this statement by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur that due to being situated in a marginal position, living entities who are averse to Hari assume the nature of mixed consciousness. In other words, when the marginal energy mixes, the marginal energy living entity mixes with the material energy, when the marginal energy living entities mix with the material energy, they consider themselves the enjoyers and then enter the material world. So this godbrother was pointing out, here it says that the fall down is from the marginal position. And he was taking that to mean not from Krishna's personal association in Leela, but it must be something like Shantaras or Brahmajyoti. The transcendental position of the living entity in between. So, but, yes, that statement is there, but one should also read what came before that statement. Maharaj, wouldn't you agree that that's a wise policy? One should also carefully note what has been said prior to that. So
one should never enter the mosque and perform namaz. Know that one?
No.
It's written in a book on Islam. One Muslim was always going to the mosque, used to go five times a day to do namaz. Then he stopped coming. And the mullah saw him on the street and said, "Why did you stop?" He said, "Well, I saw a book on Islam and it's written there. I was reading in the book. And at the bottom of the page, there's a statement, one should never go to the mosque and perform namaz." So the mullah looked at him, he turned over the page on the next page, said, "Without first washing hands and feet."
Yes. This is called selective reading. You see. So on page 100, pages 137 and 8, 137, 138, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur makes very clear that what he called, or what in the translation is termed, the transcendental impersonalist Brahmana and the yogi and the devotee are all situated in the non-material kingdom. So this is one point. This is in reference to the Bhagavata verse, Vedanti tattva tattva vadastadyad jnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdite, that there are three levels of transcendence. There's realization of impersonal Brahman, there is realization of Paramatma, and there is realization of Bhagavan. And this is within the advayam, the non-dual transcendental realm. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur clearly states that within what is translated as the non-material kingdom, which must mean the spiritual world, there are what are termed transcendental impersonalist brahmanas, yogis, and devotees. Then on page 137, he explains that the brahmanas, those transcendental impersonal brahmanas, they may become yogis, they may go up one step, or they may become devotees, they may go up two steps. He also explains that yogis can go up one step and become devotees, or they can, the word is used, degrade. They can degrade and become transcendental impersonalist brahmanas. It's interesting use of word, the word degrade. This is still referring to the spiritual world, but they can drop down to the stage of impersonalist brahmanas. Then he says that the yogis may, and in quotations, fall from the path of devotional service. The devotees may fall from the path of devotional service and become yogis or transcendental impersonalist brahmanas. Then he goes on to say that these brahmanas, in turn, may become affected by the material qualities. In other words, they may come in contact with the material nature. So then, we have to relate that to this statement we heard here before. Due to being situated in the marginal position, living entities who are averse to Hari assume the nature of mixed consciousness, etc., etc., etc. So he makes that clear, that it's these transcendental impersonalist brahmanas who, he says also, then their impersonal knowledge, their impersonal realization becomes dormant. That becomes dormant, inactive, and they become brahmanas in the material world within Varna Ashram Dharma. And then he says, then they can mix further with the mode and modes of nature, and these brahmanas then become Kshatriyas. And even further, Vaishyas appear. And then finally Shudras. So his argument in this book is that originally there was only one Varna, the brahmanas. And due to their mixing with more and more gross modes of nature, the other varnas manifest. And those material brahmanas came down from the position of transcendental impersonalist brahmanas. So you may know that there's a letter from Srila Prabhupada when Srila Prabhupada was asked, do the spirit souls fall down into the material world from the position of impersonal Brahman? Is that the fall down from impersonal Brahman to the material world? Srila Prabhupada said, the impersonal Brahman is already a fallen position. So we have some light on this. From Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So I thought you might find that interesting. As I say, I'm not here to talk about that, but we do have to address this and clarify it. So one will find, you see, this is the first thing. If one goes afield and starts to read the books of other acharyas, first of all, one must be competent to do that in the first place. One of my godbrothers remembers that Srila Prabhupada came to see him in his office. He had service as a temple manager, so he had an office. And on the shelf in the office there were books. And so he had a book by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur from the Gaudiya Math in translation. And Prabhupada looked at that and said, what is that book? And he explained that book. And then Srila Prabhupada wanted to know, have you read and assimilated all my books? So one, you know, we may think, well, book by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there are stalwart Vaishnavacharyas, why can we not read? But Srila Prabhupada wanted to know, first of all, have you read all of my books? And moreover, have you assimilated them, digested them? So that's the first point. And then, when reading, we may find this or that quotation that seems to contradict what we know from Srila Prabhupada, but then one has to investigate very, very, very carefully. Like Maharaj said, make sure that one is not just reading half a sentence or half a portion of a doctrine which is completed somewhere else on another page or another chapter or another volume. You see. And these are all examples of what Srila Prabhupada is warning us about in the very first quotation I read, about inattention and carelessness. You see. One can be inattentive and careless in one's study, and the rascal mind, or the mind becomes a rascal due to the influence of, just like Maharaj was saying this morning, thinking I know something. My godbrother Dutakarma was, I was once corresponding with him, and he was pointing that out, how so many times he's seen devotees, they come across a quotation here, there, somewhere, or they also may speculate something from reading, they speculate some understanding, and then they latch onto it. They just latch onto it and it becomes a flag. Mm-hmm. And they start to wave it wildly. And they're just, you know, it's just half-baked. They really don't know what they're talking about. But they think they know something, and now they want to run it up the flagpole and beat the drum. Look, here, special realization. And I was actually quite closely associated for a number of years with one godbrother who was prone to that sort of thinking. He's no longer an active member of ISKCON. So, carelessness and inattention. This is a very good illustration of that. So, now, we want to proceed to the history of the creation. History means Puran. And so creation, Sarga Visarga, that is one of the traditional subjects of Puranas. And of course the Srimad Bhagavatam is the Amal, spotless Purana. So there we will find the pristine account of how this creation has come into being. But I want to make a few preliminary philosophical remarks about this, about history, and about reality. I hope you find this helpful and interesting. So we were talking in previous days about different conceptions of reality that have come out of philosophy, like Pratyakshavad, the idea that reality is what we perceive this, with the senses, Anumanavad, the idea that reality is what we understand with the mind. Now, in modern times, these conceptions are still there, but you know, they, as time goes on, they get different names, and with different names, there's different ways of explaining the same old thing. So, I just want to introduce you to what is now termed consensus reality and objective reality. This is useful to know in dealing with today's mundane intellectuals. So consensus, the word consensus means agreement, agreement between people. So one type of reality is that which we agree upon. And the other type, objective, means that which is obviously there. Like this wall, obviously there. We could, you know, have a discussion among, you know, different, you're all nice devotees, but suppose this was more of an assembly of speculators. So we might have a discussion about the existence of this wall, and some may take the position, the wall doesn't exist actually. It's not really there. So we might invite that person, well, if it's not there, why don't you go to that side of the room and take a good run with your head straight out in this direction. And we'll see if the wall is actually there or not. And so if he does that, he's going to collide with this wall, and it will obviously be painful for the top of his head. So this would be objective reality. I mean, it's very hard to argue about the non-reality of something like a wall. It is so apparent. Consensus reality is, to give an example, justice. Now, have you ever seen a justice? I mean, have you ever walked through a forest and seen a justice tree growing? Or have you ever gone to a restaurant and ordered a justice salad? Justice is not something that we can measure, you see, with a microscope or do a chemical test on it. But everyone agrees that justice is real. Justice is something, it is an absolute necessity for human society. We can't get on without it. Even in ISKCON, we have to have justice. So many devotees are calling, justice! So, justice is a conception, an ideal, but we agree that it is necessary, it must be. You can't have a society without it. So this is a way, and again, something that objective is just unarguable, that's just there in front of the senses. It can be measured very easily with physical measuring instruments. So this is the distinction that they make. Consensus reality, objective reality, and both are admitted to be very, very necessary, but they're of somewhat different natures of reality. All right? No, not all right. There's a word, vyavahar. This is conventional, this is convenient, this is useful. But if you probe into it, you find that this distinction doesn't stand very careful examination. Now let's take the example of a rainbow. Now, if it rains and then after the rain, a rainbow is in the sky, isn't that objective? I mean, don't we all see it? Isn't it? If I call you to the balcony and say, look, won't you all see the rainbow? Yes, we won't have any argument. No, there's no bow of green and red and yellow and violet, whatever. Everyone will say, yes, it's there. But is it objectively there? So, there's a rainbow. Let's go walk underneath it. Let's go find the edge of it, where it starts. Like maybe we'll find a pot of gold there. So then we will be faced with the grave difficulty that the more we walk towards the rainbow, the more it's moving in front of us away. And we can never seem to get physically nearer to it. So there is something there that we all see objectively with the senses. But at the same time, it is not quite there. So, now this example is just to help you understand the next step. The next step is that modern science tells us that actually our experience of this room, this wall, all these objective things around us, is very much like the experience of the rainbow. Because this wall is composed of chemical molecules, which are themselves composed of atoms, which are themselves composed of subatomic particles. And these, when you get on that scale, they're separated by vast spaces. You know, just like they look at through the telescope at the cosmos, and you know, there's a galaxy here, and millions of light years away there's a galaxy there, separated by that. So they say, on the microcosmic scale, they're similar. Vast distances. And over here you have a neutron, and over there you have a proton, and over there you have an electron. You see? And then, even worse, when you take it further, you see, we're still talking in somewhat objective terms when we say, well, at least there's a proton, at least. But quantum mechanics, quantum physics brings you to a point where even the proton is not really there. The proton is not even really there. And the neutron is not really there. And the electron is not really there. And then you've got all these problems. Where does it really exist? It's just like the rainbow. You see, there is this, in quantum physics, what's called the observer principle. The observer principle is that things are there when you look at them. So consciousness is required, in other words. And this is a valid point from the Vedic. Of course, they take it to all kinds of absurd lengths, but Vedically speaking, that is a fact. Without consciousness, there can be no manifest world. And we're going to, I'm telling you, this is a prelude to what we're going to be going into, because without consciousness, there cannot be an explanation of creation. So this observer principle, I'll give you, try to make it a little clear. You may not be so interested, but I'll just give an example. Because they say these subatomic particles, proton, electron, etc., they call them wave particles, which means they exhibit both the properties of a wave and a particle. So imagine a surfer. You all know these fellows who ride the surfboards. See them, Hawaii, Australia, also Bali and Indonesia is a good place for surfing. Nice waves. So you have a wave front, a long length of water moving into the shore in the form of a curled wave. And then on the top, in one spot, you have the surfer on his board. And he's balancing and coming in with the wave. Now, quantum physics tells us that a photon, a light particle, for example, yes, that's something like the surfer, but the problem is, as long as the wave is out there in the ocean, you can't say where the surfer is. The surfer could be anywhere along the whole length of the wave. You understand? There's a surfer out there, but you can't say where he is. Only when the wave comes to the beach. What is the beach? The beach is consciousness. Then suddenly, as to use their jargon, the wave front collapses. Oh, there's the surfer. You see? So before he comes to the beach, you can't see him. Before the photon reaches our consciousness, we can't really say that it's there. It exists in a sort of fuzzy virtual state. So all kinds of, you know, philosophical problems come up with this. And it's mainly because what is consciousness to these people? Consciousness means human consciousness only. Now we know the whole existence is existing. Also when we're not looking at it, when we go to sleep at night, it's not that everything dissolves into a fog of, you know, zipping blips just because we're asleep. Because the Lord is always observing this material existence. This is the Bhagavatam statement. As long as the Lord continues to observe this creation, it continues to exist. So everything is existing under Sa'aikshata, the supreme vision of the Lord. So it is not solipsism. Solipsism, there's a term, solipsism. The idea that everything is based on my own consciousness. You see, that you're just figments of my mind. I'm really just here talking to myself. You don't really exist. There, if you come from our background, kind of, you know, we met fellows like that who would ponder these things, you know, very intensely. Maybe I'm the only one who exists here. Certain chemicals, they assist one in that type of realization. There's certain substances which, when ingested and they go into the brain, they help one have these kind of realizations. So I don't recommend you take them. Anyway, so now these modern scientists, you see, they think consciousness means human consciousness, and they think human consciousness is emergent. That means, like Prabhupada explains, at a certain stage of material combination, consciousness manifests. It's this emergent idea is something like, I was saying yesterday, water, what is it? They say two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen. So these are two gases. There's no evidence of liquidity in these two gases. But you put them together in that proportion, and then liquidity, this state of liquidness, suddenly emerges from this combination of two kinds of gas. So they say in the same way, consciousness emerges. You just put together different material substances, different chemicals, enough and complicated enough, and then at some point, as the French say, voila! There it is. Consciousness just is there. And then if you start to remove some of these ingredients, consciousness disappears. So this is how they think. Consciousness is emergent. Now, all of this was by way of an introduction to history. Now, how does this connect with history? I'll tell you. Now, when I was a boy, when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, I used to devour books on prehistory. I knew all the ages that scientists, you know, there was this Mesoic age, and before that the Cretaceous age, and then the Jurassic age, and then the Triassic age, and all these different living entities lived in those ages. And I used to have books with really wonderful color paintings, Tyrannosaurus Rex attacking a Triceratops, and in the background there's a volcano exploding and a pteranodon, the flying dinosaur, off in the horizon, and palm trees, and they would often have a little rat-like mammal somewhere crouching in the corner, hiding from the dinosaur, the first mammal. He will evolve and become men later on, millions of years later. So this whole world of prehistory is presented to us in these scientific work. And they go back, and they say there was this primordial hot ocean, bubbling ocean, and lightning bolts flashing down out of a stormy sky into the ocean. And the ocean was full of all kinds of chemicals, newly formed chemicals, and the lightning interacted. And then somehow or other, this protoplasmic sludge appeared on the surface of this ocean and was bubbling away. And then a little cell formed, and then that cell divided, and that those two cells divided more. And this is how it all began. And then before that, Earth was just a molten hot globe of magma, liquid hot substance. You see, all the minerals were just in this hot reddish orange liquid state, smoking, and this Earth had been ejected from the sun. And as it was ejected, it divided in half, and the other part became the moon later on. So they have this whole scenario, and they describe it in very picturesque language. You really see it, and they have pictures of it too. They draw pictures, and you enter this world. Fantastic. So when I was a kid, I was really fascinated with all this. But later on, I became more philosophical, and I began to read some books by, these are Western philosophers, but they're deep thinkers, and they have raised some fundamental objections which are very valid and which help us to understand the position of Vedic Shabda vis-a-vis all other ways of narration. Because here they are, they're telling you what it was like back in the age of the dinosaurs. They make movies now, successful Jurassic Park and all these, you know, billion-dollar movies. And everyone believes it was like that. But I told you before that what we see, according to science itself, the form of what we see depends on what? Huh? What did I say?
Consciousness.
You see, that is why we see things as we see them. Otherwise, what is objectively there, according to this quantum physical science, is just virtual particles, they call it. It's just a haze of so many particles just blipping around randomly. There's no pattern at all. It's just a cloud. You see? Just a big haze, a fog. And only when there's consciousness, oh, here we are sitting in this room having a philosophy seminar. Take away consciousness, and it's just a fog. Buzzing fog. Something like impersonal Brahman. You see? Just a big light and a steady eternally. That's all there is. You see, Prabhupada is very accurate in saying these scientists are impersonalists. So, and they say, I told you, that consciousness means human consciousness, and that emerged when? Oh, maybe 400,000 years ago. See, in some African desert, some ape-like creature suddenly stood up a little straight and looked around, and something happened in its brain, some last, final, fine adjustment of evolution, something happened. Then he scratched his head. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. The first philosopher. So they say that happened maybe 400,000 years ago. They, you know, different dates, but it wasn't in terms of, you know, the whole scenario of prehistory. It wasn't that long ago. You see? And yet, they take you back before that time. They take, as I said, back to the age of dinosaurs, back to the age of the primordial sea in which protoplasm appeared, back to when the Earth came out of the sun. All of this they're telling you about. But how can they tell you about that? There was no consciousness then. That means the only thing that was there was just this haze, of this buzzing haze of random virtual particles. Objectively, that's all that was there. So what are they doing? I'll tell you what they're doing. They're cheating you, that's all. This is what Prabhupada meant by word juggling. You see? And this is a wonderful proof that the only true account of history is the Vedic Puranic account. This is a wonderful logical proof. Because the Vedas are a Purusheya. They did not emerge 400,000 years ago. They're eternal. There's eternal shabda, eternal sound vibration emanating from the consciousness of the Lord Himself, the breathing of Mahavishnu, as the universes are coming out, the sound of His breathing is the Veda, the Vedic sound, and it is that Vedic sound, according to the Vedas themselves, that is giving form to the sound in ether, evolves, you see, ether, then air, then fire, then water, then earth. This is all an evolute of Shabda, sound. You see? So the background of everything is sound. And the Vedas express that sound. And the scientists also, they say ultimately everything is vibration. You see? The wave particle is nothing more than some type of vibration. But they don't know what the vibration says. They have no, in fact, they say, unless there's human consciousness, it doesn't say anything. But we say, no. The vibration is an emanation of the Lord's supreme consciousness. And the Lord is eternal, His consciousness is eternal. Therefore, this vibration, the knowledge that is conveyed by this vibration, is also eternal. And therefore, only those who are followers of the Vedas, bona fide followers of the Vedas, can talk about the history of the world. How about that for an argument? How can they talk about the history of the world? They can't. By their own philosophy, they cannot. Is it clear? Anyone want to argue against it?
Well, you're accepting as an axiom that the Vedas are Purusheya, but that in itself is stated in the Vedas. So it seems to be that you're.
This is.
Blind, what's that called?
Circular reasoning.
Circular reasoning.
Well, you see, logic. This is the problem with logic. Speaking of logic, logic is circular by nature. It's like computer. Computers function by logic. There's a logical system programmed into the software, and the hardware is also designed according to logic. And this is how a computer works. So it's a closed system of logic. It's ultimately moving in a great circle, closed system. So if something goes wrong in that system, sometimes what happens in the computer, they call it a hang. The logical function of the computer enters a very small loop, you see? It due to some mistake, either something the user did or the programming, but the logic begins to chase its own tail in a very tight little circle. And that's when, you know, your screen freezes, whatever you do, nothing happens, you know, you press any key, and you just have to, what? You have to close down the whole system. Now, the system itself can't do that. The computer cannot reset itself. Someone outside that closed little world has to press the reset button, or pull the plug, do something. And then the logic resets itself and can function normally. So you see, this is the problem of all logical systems. They're closed. And because of the way logic is, I have on my computer a whole, about 4 pages of logical fallacies, you see, with their Latin terminology. And when you read these things, you quickly understand that almost anything you say in ordinary conversation is a logical fallacy. Could be pointed out, you know, some you know, really, you know, attentive and severe logical type of person could point everything you say. Wait, that is argumentum ad ignorantum. That is, you know, there's all these. You see, it haunts everything we say. Logical fallacy. So it's very easy for logic to slip into one of these loops. Our own human logical structures also can slip into some kind of loop. And even in Krishna consciousness, we give analogies. Prabhupada gave so many analogies to illustrate metaphysical points. But these analogies can be challenged. You see, wait a minute. You see, just like, can you think of an example?
Blind man, lame man.
You want to explain that?
No, I'm just giving the analogy. I'm not saying how it's a challenge.
Okay, so that's good. Blind man, lame man. So, one man who's blind, then, but he has a strong body, he can take on his shoulders a lame man who has eyes and point the way. So this is an analogy that can be used for different things. Srila Prabhupada used it for Western culture, for example, Western material science, technology is very strong but blind, and the Vedic knowledge of India is lame, weak in the modern time. So the combination of the two can make one strong entity. So someone can raise some objections with, you know, based on the analogy itself, that, well, that would be very difficult, you know, for them to be together all the time. I mean, he may be very strong, but a man sitting on another man's shoulders for a few hours is going to wear him out. He's going to want to put that man down. Or what about when they have to eat? Or what about when they have to pass stool? Or what about... So one can come up with so many objections based on the analogy. But then, what is the reply? We say, well, that's just an analogy to help you understand. We step out of that loop of logic, you see? And we say, this is just to help you understand. Don't take it literally. And a person who would take every analogy literally would be, you know, he'd be a blockhead. I mean, he would be very difficult to teach him anything. So anyway, this is the fallacy that's inherent in logic. So, this was your initial question, was that when we say that it is a testimony of the Vedas that they are eternal, that this is what's called, there's a Latin, anyway, vicious circle. Circulus, I forgot now the term, there's a Latin term, a vicious circle. This is also in Sanskrit, chakraka, circular logic. The same thing is there in Sanskrit logic, Indian logic. So, but we have to understand that one must step out of logic. There is a higher plane of understanding than simply logic. And so the truth that the Vedas are eternal cannot be established simply on that basis, but it can be realized, you see. But it can be realized if we practice the method, the vidhi, that is taught in the Vedic scriptures. So scientists say the same thing about their theories, that water is composed of two gases. That's not evident to our senses. You see? And one could raise the same objection. You scientists, you're saying this is composed of two gases, but this is not evident to me, and you're simply asking me to accept your testimony. You're a scientist, and you're saying science says that water is composed of two gases, so that's also superior logic. But they have a way to test this. But then you have to, like I was saying the other day, then you have to surrender to that method. If you say, no, I think that your method... Your way of demonstrating, of your process of experimentation to show this, it's all bogus. I don't accept it from, you know, a priori, from the very beginning. I just don't accept it. It's all bogus. So then you can never know. You can never... that is your prejudice. Pre-justice. You come to a conclusion beforehand. So that's called prejudice. That's not indicative of serious thinking. So, the scientists also have a method for going beyond the circular, you know, the circles of their own words. And so similarly, there's a Vedic method. But the laboratory of the Vedic method is consciousness. We have to purify our consciousness. Then we can realize eternality. The eternality of the soul, the eternality of the Vedic message, the Vedic sound. The eternality of the Lord. His name, form, qualities, pastimes, activities. There is a method, but we have to surrender to it. All right, then, that was all by the way of introducing Vedic history, the Vedic count of history. It is the only sensible account, because all the others rule themselves out by saying consciousness manifested 400,000 years ago. So they, on their own grounds, they cannot speak of anything before. They should just shut up. This is the point. Their own, like the Buddhists, like all the impersonalists, by their own philosophy, they shouldn't be speaking. But still they speak. They say the truth. They even say the material world can't be expressed in words. What to speak of the absolute truth? But they go on talking, talking, talking. They say when one has achieved nirvan or brahman, then one becomes like a full pot, and a full pot makes no sound. But there they are, sitting on their high asans, riding on their elephants at Kumbh Mela, making so many sounds. Over loudspeakers. You see? Telling you everything is one. You are me, I am you. We are the walrus. Blah, blah, blah. That's only when someone tries to object, they say, words are not enough. When the Vaishnavas speak, then they say, you cannot discuss this in words. Anyway. So only the Vaishnava philosophy has a cogent and coherent philosophy of language. The Shabda Prama. And therefore we can speak about the origin of the world. And another thing that's important to talk about before going further is the point of dimensions of consciousness. Because in this knowledge, one can become very bewildered. For instance, the fifth canto description of the universe seems to be very bewildering if one approaches it in a unidimensional way, thinking that everything described there is the same dimensions that we're experiencing here and now. So what do we mean by dimensions, first of all? Well, typically there are three dimensions. You can see them in this corner. You can see that there is height, and there is width, and there is length. And these lines of height, length, and width are coming together in this corner. This is three dimensions. Now, the thing is that this can be described mathematically. You can take some... This is the way they do it in algebra and so on. Take some letter that represents value of dimension, y, and then you put above it 1, you know, the raised exponent 1. And that will stand for one of these dimensions, let's say length. And then you put above, again, you take y and put 2 above, and then that will stand for height. And then 3 will stand for width. You see, so you can describe mathematically these three dimensions. Now, but with mathematics, you can take a y and put 4 above, and 5, and 6, and 7, and 8, and 9, and 10. So, mathematically speaking, mathematicians already know, they already conceive of more dimensions than what we experience. And they can even, some of them, generate on computer graphics. They can produce an object which, as it would appear in, say, 4 or 5 dimensions. And it looks very strange when you see it. Something's happening here at all. Which couldn't happen, you know, on this level of our experience. So it looks very odd when you see it. And some astrophysicists, they say they're observing such sort of higher dimensional phenomena. They have observed such things on Saturn and their telescopes and on other planets. So some of them are suspecting that there are higher dimensions to other planets based on this. Now, this is, I'm not trying to say that this is a very widespread point of view, but I have come across it. Based on things, strange phenomena that they observe that can be, you know, can be reproduced on a computer as higher dimensional, something higher dimensional happening. So at least in theory, mathematically speaking, higher dimensions are already known and accepted, you see. So this, I'm mentioning mathematics particularly, because this is the mind. This is consciousness. So actually when we talk of dimensions, we're talking about consciousness, really. You see, our consciousness is now conditioned by these senses we have. So our consciousness is now moving in three, or when they add time, they say four dimensions. But even in the mind, theoretically, one can imagine more dimensions than just this three or four. So when we read that there are 8,400,000 species of life, this should be understood as 8,400,000 dimensions of consciousness. And some of them are overlapping. Actually, Brahmaji's consciousness is including all the others, but very few of the other levels of consciousness are including his. You see? And the Lord, he's including everything, and only by his sweet will can anyone else's consciousness interact with his consciousness. So you have in this universe 8,400,000 levels of consciousness. Now, coming back to this length, breadth, height, there was several books have been written in the last over 100 years. One of them was called Flatland. This is to help us to understand higher dimensions. So this book, Flatland, was proposing living entities who live only in two dimensions. You see? In other words, width and length, a flat plane. But they have no height. So they just live on a surface, and living entities are just, they're just like marks on a surface. You see? Like you could draw a circle. And this is their world, and they know one another when their two, you know, edges touch, and then here's another one of us here. So someone who lives in three dimensions is like a demigod. You see, he looks down from above and he sees everything. They are only able to see when they come in touch with one another on the edge. But he's able to see the whole panorama of their world from above. And he's able to see not only outside of them, he sees right inside them. He sees inside and outside simultaneously, which they can't do. You see? And he can create all kinds of what they would say supernatural effects. By just, you know, reaching down and moving things around. Maybe reaching through that plane. Just like you can imagine if these living entities were living on the surface of a bowl of dal, you see, on the surface of dal, they have their world. And then you come with your spoon and start to spoon up the dal. How would they experience that? Some bizarre thing is suddenly piercing through our whole world and expanding and contracting in a way that we've never experienced before. And then things are suddenly disappearing. You see, whole features of our reality are suddenly just vanishing. How is it possible? For them, it's a whole mind-boggling experience. But for us who live in three dimensions, it's very normal. So then above us, there are demigods who live in higher dimensions. They look on our world and they see everything inside and outside in one glance. And they, with very simple actions of their own, they can create havoc, or they can create wonders, miracles. For them, it's just very simple. You know, a gesture like that, or... Yeah. And we go, wow. And all the Hindu temples are filling up with fervent devotees praying, please, oh demigod, give us, please, oh Muruga, please, Ganesh, do something for us, wonderful. So this is also very necessary in understanding anything as presented in the Vedic literature. So then, we want to proceed with creation. Now, in the Upanishads, and also in the Pancharatrik literature, like there's a scripture called Ahirbhudna Samhita, and in several Upanishads, we learn of a fourfold creation. The universe is manifesting in four stages. And in these scriptures, these four stages are four aspects of the Absolute, of the Supreme Being. So the first aspect is known as Brahman, the second as Ishvara, the third as Hiranyagarbha, and the fourth as Virat. And associated with these four, there are stages of consciousness. Turiya, which is pure consciousness above the three gunas. Pragya, which is intelligence in Abhyakta. Abhyakta means the unmanifest. Actually, this is primordial tamoguna, the Abhyakta. But when consciousness is manifest in that, that is called pragya, or also susupti. Actually, they're different. Pragya means, just like in yoga, in trance, the body, if the body would be, a yogi in trance, if the body would be examined by a doctor, he would say, physiologically speaking, this person is asleep, or even in a state less than sleep, like unconsciousness, coma even. Hardly any life symptoms can be found. And sometimes the yogis are so expert that practically they would say the body's dead. You see? But they're able, there are some Western doctors and so on who have studied this, and they admit that yogis have the power to to slow down all the metabolism, slow the heart rate down very much. So this is analogous to a state of sleep or even unconsciousness, coma, something like that. And yet, the yogi is conscious. He's in meditation. He's in trance. He's aware. So this is pragya, actually. So I mentioned Lord Shiva and other great, great personalities. They are situated, in other words, they are, materially speaking, inactive, practically inactive. Generally, always observe, you always see Lord Shiva, generally, how is he shown? Sitting in meditation. He also has activities, but for long, long, long periods, he's in meditation. But that doesn't mean he's in susupti, that he's just unconscious like we are. So these two things there simultaneously at this is the Ishvara state. Pragya and Susupti. Ishvara means Lord Shiva. Ishvara also means Mahavishnu, the Lord himself. And then there's below, then at the Hiranyagarbha stage, the consciousness is called Taijasa, creative intelligence, which is equivalent to Svapna, or dream. In dream state, our desires start to come out. First, we're in deep sleep, and then our desires start to come out in the mind. And this is on the higher level, cosmic level, this is called Taijasa. This is the power of creation. And in our own, I told you the other day about Samasti Vyasti. So in our own Vasti Vyasti state, we experience this as dream. And then in the consciousness at the Virat level is Jagrata, wakefulness. And in this state also Ahamkara, false ego, is very strong. So, this is, as I said, described in the Upanishads and in the Pancharatrik literature. And we find this fully developed. These are indications, but these indications are fully developed in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Here's a quotation of a verse from Canto 11, Chapter 5 of Srimad Bhagavatam. Actually, this is the purport to verses 29 and 30. The Supreme Living Entity, Krishna, eternally manifests Himself as the Chatur Vyuha, or quadruple plenary expansion. The purpose of this prayer is that one should give up his false ego and pray to the Chatur Vyuha by offering them obeisances. Although the Absolute Truth is one without a second, the Absolute Truth displays His unlimited opulences and potencies by expanding Himself in innumerable plenary forms, of which the Chatur Vyuha is a principal expansion. Original being is Vasudeva, the personality of Godhead. When the Godhead manifests His primeval energies and opulences, He is called Sankarshan. Pradyumna is the basis of the Vishnu expansion, who is the soul of the entire universe. Hiranyagarbha, in other words. And Aniruddha is the basis of the personal manifestation of Vishnu as the super soul of every individual entity within the universe. Among the four plenary expansions mentioned here, the original expansion is Vasudeva, and the other three are considered to be particular manifestations of Him. When the living entity forgets but that both he himself as well as the material nature are meant for the Lord's service, the quality of ignorance becomes prominent and the conditioned entity desires to become himself the master. Srila Prabhupada writes in purport of Chaitanya Charitamrita, the first Purusha avatar, Mahavishnu, in the causal ocean, who is the creator of the aggregate material energy, is an expansion of Sankarshan. The second Purusha, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, is an expansion of Pradyumna, and the third Purusha, Chirodakshaya Vishnu, is an expansion from Aniruddha. So the whole of creation and the different stages of consciousness, different conceptions of the self, Brahmabhuta, Karana Sharira, Linga Sharira, Stula Sharira, different stages of creation, Brahman, Mahat, Taijasa, Vishva, all of these have their source in the Chatur Vyuha. Is that clear? This means no, it's not clear. So, what is not understood?
Sankarshan?
Yes.
Pradyumna, they are the three.
What?
Mahavishnu is Sankarshan.
Yes.
And then Pradyumna is Garbhodaka Vishnu, Aniruddha is Shirodakasa Vishnu.
You're not speaking loud enough, I can't hear you.
Aniruddha is the Shirodakasa Vishnu.
Yes.
Pradyumna is the
Garbhodaka Vishnu. Hiranyagarbha.
After that, I couldn't hear.
Huh? After that,
I couldn't
hear. After that? Could you explain the portion after that? You can explain the
is Pradyumna or is manifested from?
Is manifested from.
Yes, it says, it states here that the Vasudeva is the original source. And then elsewhere we find that of the others, then Sankarshan or Mahavishnu is the source of the other two. So in this way they're proceeding. But then again, you should not think of this too much in linear terms, because we find in teachings of Lord Chaitanya the visualization of the four forms of the Lord is like a square. You see? Four sides of a square. And in the middle, there is Krishna, or Narayan, because there are two stages of Vyuha. There's Vyuha, in which the Sankarshan Balaram and Pradumna, Krishna's son, and Aniruddha, Krishna's grandson. And this is in terms of Vrindavan, Mathura, and Dwarka. And then in Vaikuntha, Mahanarayan expands further Vyuha, Vasudev, Sankarshan, Pradumna, Aniruddha. And from this expansion is taking place within the field of the material creation. And so by the influence of the Sankarshan, Pradumna, Aniruddha, the different stages of creation, and all of this is all interlinked. Stages of consciousness, Turiya, Pragya, or Susupti, Svapna, Jagrata. And you see, the super soul in our own heart, it is incorrect to sever him from the Vyuhas before. Because like Brihadaranyaka Upanishad states, every night that we are going to Brahman, in other words, we're going to Mahavishnu. That Susupti stage, that deep sleep, is actually associated with Mahavishnu. Every night you're meeting Mahavishnu. How do you like that? And this is why I took such pains to make this point about consciousness. Consciousness has to be kept as the foundation of all of this description. Otherwise, if we become too external in our attempt to understand this, as the mundaners do, trying to understand everything in terms of external, you know, linear dimension, then it becomes very, very, well, that's what happens. Then that's why the mundaners don't believe this. And mundane science, mundane philosophy, you can see as it comes more and more to modern times, consciousness is more and more removed from their scheme. They don't want to admit that there is such a thing as consciousness. They want to explain everything in terms of matter. So in our philosophy, it's the exact opposite. Consciousness is practically everything. And matter is just an effect. It's just a footnote to consciousness. So, this is all, and there's a lot of information packed into this. And I think it, somehow I feel I would like to proceed on the basis of any further discussion or questions. I could go to the next stage, but that is also quite involved, and I would rather wait until tomorrow for that, where we actually start to talk about the structure of the mind, both cosmically and individually. The structure of the mind, and by this way we see the structure of our conditioned state and how we are relating with the universe. But on this point, I find this, you know, personally, this was for me a great state of illumination when I understood this, about these four stages of creation, which are clearly there in the Bhagavatam, and how they relate to the Chaturvyuha. And this way you can understand the stages of creation simply in terms of these four forms of the Lord. In the end of his purport in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, verse 4, Srila Prabhupada quotes from this from Sattvata Tantra, which states, "For material creation, Lord Krishna's plenary expansions assumes three Vishnus. The first one, Mahavishnu, creates the total material energy, known as the Mahatattva. The second, Garbhodakasha Vishnu, enters into all the universes to create diversities in each of them. The third, Chirodakasha Vishnu, is diffused as the all-pervading super soul in all the universes and is known as Paramatma. He is present even within the atoms. Anyone who knows these three Vishnus can be liberated from material entanglement. So even things that are going on within this body, because as I said, this body is Chudra Brahmanda. It's just a very tiny sample of the whole universe. And we are passing every day. I mean, even the materialist is passing every day through Jagrata, Svapna, Susupti, and back again. And we are supposed to be developing transcendental consciousness, Turiya consciousness, Vasudeva consciousness, Krishna consciousness, which means associating with the Lord without any obstruction. In these other states, there is some obstruction. Consciousness is obstruction. Obstructed why? And that's simply, the basis of that is our desire, what we want. In I think it was in Mumbai, on a walk in Juhu Beach, I think. I'm 90% sure this is the place, but 100% sure of what Srila Prabhupada said. Srila Prabhupada was walking with his disciples, and suddenly he turned to them and said, "Why are you attracted to sex?" And this was this very heavy question. And the disciples were... And Prabhupada, he was looking and... "Why are you attracted to sex?" And they really didn't know how to answer. It was an embarrassing question and also a philosophical question. So the embarrassment and the philosophy kind of combined to stun everyone. And Prabhupada asked another third time at least, "Why are you attracted to sex?" And when there was no answer, Prabhupada smiled and he said, "Because you want to be. Because you want to be." And that's at the basis of everything. Our consciousness is obstructed from the Lord, separated from the Lord. His energies are working in this bina way to separate us from Him because we want it to be that way. And that is because we want to be the enjoyer.
I like
your
it.
Point. I like it. I want to be Krishna, you were saying. Srila Prabhupada, this is what we must... No, this was... You were saying when he was speaking with Giriraj Maharaj, that was you this morning?
Yeah.
Telling them.
Yeah.
That you have to answer the question, do you want to serve Krishna?
Do you want to serve God or you want to be God?
Serve or be. So because we want to be... And that means be the enjoyer, and therefore we are being punished for that. Namam duskritino mudha. Srila Prabhupada said, "I believe very, very strongly in this verse that people fall into these categories of duskritina and mudha and naradama and asura and maya pitagyana. They fall into these condemned categories because of one thing: they will not surrender to Krishna." Prabhupada said, "I believe very strongly in this verse." So that this is the ultimate answer to question: Why is someone a demon? Why do demons do all these bad things? Why can't they? You were saying in your question, why can't they understand? We're trying to preach to them. Why are they so dull? Maharaj said that when he tried to explain something using the example of a blind man, just a rhetorical example. Why are you against blind people? I had the same experience once in New Zealand. I was speaking, and I was speaking how people, they follow the mode of ignorance to the most absurd extreme, to where you see these drunkards living under a bridge. You see in the big cities, major cities of the world, like even Paris, which is considered to be a jewel of European cities. But look under the bridges, you find these, what in America we call winos. You see, their whole life is, if they can just get wine, they're happy. And they don't care where, they'll just live under a bridge. That's some covering over the head. Live under the bridge, drink wine, wear, 3-year-old ragged clothing that's never been changed in all that time. Never take bath. You smell them from 5 meters away. So I was giving this, how people, they follow their desires into the depths of ignorance, and this is how they end up living under a bridge. And then there was some girl in the audience, and she shouted out, she said, "But these people are the most enlightened of all. They're the ones who really know what life is." And what can you say? You know, what can you say? And so we ask, how can people be so foolish? But they fall into these categories. This is the point. So Maya Pritagyana, you see, or Asura, or Naradama, or Mudha. Why is a person of Mudha so dull? Prabhupada said, because they will not surrender to Krishna. I believe in this very strong. So this is the basis of everything. And so we are still within the Leela of the Lord, and now His Leela is manifesting this external feature. These vyuhas, they're interacting with the material nature, and we are trapped in the process. We are caught up in the process because of this attitude we have. I will not serve the Lord. I want to be the Lord. So the Lord is playing with His energies, and the Lord is saying to the jiva, so, you want to be like me? Here's the material energy, go. You play too, but you see, material nature plays very rough with the jiva. You want to play with Maya, but she won't play according to our rules. She won't play, you know, what we want, how we want the game to go. That I'll be the winner. You see? I'll come out the champion. No. So. Anything? Yes. What is the difference between mind and consciousness? Well, I mentioned that yesterday. There's a state of mind called tattva, the original state, and that is pure consciousness. We read from Srila Prabhupada's letter to that Mrs. Klein that the psychological functions of thinking, feeling, willing are there in Krishna. So Krishna has His mind. And the residents of the spiritual world have their minds. And that state of mind is called tattva. That's the original state of consciousness. And then the contaminated state of the mind is vritti. So this is when the dust of material desire, dust of material contamination, falls on the mirror of the mind. Because consciousness reflects, mind reflects. Isn't it? Even now we're experiencing. Because we have consciousness, the world is reflected in it. We are aware of the world. And so that same is going on in the spiritual world. The spiritual world is reflected in the pure mind. But when dust falls upon the mirror of the mind, then we heard yesterday, Swarup Avarika, Guna Avarika. Then one loses his knowledge of spiritual form, and instead his consciousness becomes engaged in material form. Guna avarika means the coverings of the modes of nature, and out of the modes of nature, material forms are coming out. So there is a difference between pure consciousness and the material mind. Yes. But pure consciousness is the state of the pure mind. So you see, if we're speaking of pure mind, pure consciousness, then there's no difference. They're interchangeable. But if we speak of material mind, actually material mind is a subtle aspect of material nature. And we are involved with the material mind because of our desires. It's something like this, that the soul, yes, asangahi purusha, that Yogendra cited in his class. The spirit soul is never in touch with matter. matter is always something actually very far away from the spirit soul. These tanmatras, the objects of the senses, they're actually very far away from the existence of the soul. So how do we bring them near to us? It's by the agency of the mind. Just like the moon is very far away, but you can make the moon appear very close if you have a good telescope. Then you can see the mountains, everything in detail. So it's the mind is the agency of material nature by which our consciousness becomes focused on gross matter and, you know, totally absorbed in and attached to gross matter. So that is why we accept the mind. And we become so much absorbed in the mind that we can no longer distinguish ourselves from the mind. In material consciousness, everyone is thinking, I am the mind. So you had another question?
Another one. Just last sentence, or few sentences in the lecture, you said that we just wanted somehow to be play without Krishna, our own game. So Krishna gave us opportunity. So I just wonder if it was like that. So how, for example, I myself could not remember that my decision. I just want to play without Krishna on my own. And now I just cannot remember that.
That doesn't mean you're not guilty. That wouldn't stand up in a court of law. Mass murderer captured and says, I don't remember. So we let him go. He murdered 23 people. But when the police handcuffed him, he said, I don't remember. I did that? No, I don't remember. So then the chief of police, oh, he doesn't remember. Unlock the handcuffs, let him go. Because you don't remember, there's no argument of anything. Like Srila Prabhupada said, we don't remember we were in the womb of our mother, but that doesn't mean we weren't there. So our memory is very weak, and that is also the consequence of yes, this decision we have made to enjoy matter. Therefore, our position is all disturbed and uncertain. This is the situation we have put ourselves in. But you see, the fact is, whether you remember or not, it is we are part and parcel of Krishna. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada said, we are tiny samples of Krishna. Therefore, our desires are perverted expressions of Krishna's desire. So whether or not this point of remembering to make that I made a decision doesn't really matter, because right now I'm having my material desires. These desires are originally in the soul, and they are meant to be engaged in Krishna's service. We are meant to become, you know, assistants of Lord Krishna's happiness in the spiritual world. That's why these desires are originally there. But because we are now averse to Krishna, therefore these desires are coming out the other way. So, we can see that people are averse to Krishna. That's all. It's not a question that they have to remember when they made some decision. It's right now, in the present time, when devotees come to them and say, you know, take this book or chant Hare Krishna, come to the Sunday. No, too busy. No, I don't like this. No, you are brainwashed. No, you belong to a cult and you want to suck me into that cult too. And take away my freedom. I want to remain free. Like the monkey in the tree. Monkey is free. They say free is a bird. Bird is free in the tree. But is that really freedom? You see, this is their conception. I want to be free. You guys are enslaved by this dangerous cultic doctrine. Robs people. All these centuries, the human culture has been evolving towards more and more freedom. Can't you see what we have accomplished? Can't you see our society so nice? Big buildings and cars. going back and forth in airplanes, sometimes flying into buildings. No, let's talk about that. It's a wonderland we have created. And you're trying to capture people, drag them away from all this work that our ancestors have done bringing us up to this point. Now we're just on the verge of complete happiness, complete freedom, complete equality and justice, liberty and justice for all. This is what they think, and therefore they don't find Krishna consciousness attractive. This is their decision. Decision means it's an ongoing decision. At some time in the past, whatever, time immemorial, they made this decision, but they're maintaining this decision right now. The other thing, one doesn't have to remember anything in the past. One, in the very present, should change one's decision. But that requires intelligence, of course. The devotees are giving intelligence. And if one doesn't want to accept them, one remains foolish. Yes?
I want to refer to this higher dimensions. The question Srimad, fifth canto mentions the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. How we are to understand actually the descriptions of the universe? Because Bhagavatam is meant for us. We ask that we wrote Bhagavatam for us to understand it. We can say it's multi-dimensional, there are higher dimensions, but how we can understand it at all?
Yes, well, there is a definition. There is a term which is called self-evident truth. This term in philosophy, self-evident truth. So that means, for example, the sun in the sky is self-evident. You don't need some other source of illumination in order to see the sun when it's overhead. The sun shows itself to you. But still, when you look, for example, in the Cambridge Dictionary of Philosophy, look up self-evident truth, you will find that it is still said that that doesn't mean that something is self-evidently true, that everyone in any condition of life can understand that. That's not what self-evident truth means. For instance, like Maharaj was saying this morning, a blind man. Now there's the sun, self-evident, but the blind man still can't see it. Or if a person wraps his eyes up, he won't see the sun. If a person refuses to go outside, blacks all the windows, refuses to let any light in, he won't see the sun. So the sun is self-evident, but that still doesn't mean that everyone automatically can see the sun. So the same way, the fifth canto or any canto of Bhagavatam, anything in the Bhagavatam is self-evident truth. But that doesn't mean that you should just, you can understand it just like that. Read it one time. Oh yes, it's completely clear to me. No, because we are in Rajagun Tamagun. We have been in Rajagun Tamagun for countless births. So it requires a little bit of purification. You see, our vision is not clear. Self-evident truth is seen by those whose vision is clear. But our vision is not clear. So vision must be clarified, then we can see it.
Actually, it's interesting. This is a very practical question because now we are, ISKCON will have to construct this planetarium Vedic planetarium in the Mayapur. So it's interesting that some devotees are suggesting that we should consult, Oxford scholars for you. So how do you understand it?
Well, if you find an Oxford scholar who's in Turiya consciousness, above the modes of nature, yes, consult him. But if he's in Rajaguna, Tamaguna, he won't be able to help. He'll just offer some speculation. This is again what I mean. When we forget about consciousness and just become absorbed in the externals, then we run into all these problems. If you try to understand the universe, the fifth canon, no fifth canon, just the universe, you know, through the, that we see through the senses, try to understand that just in terms of external dimensions, you become confused. Like that, these astrophysicists are totally confused. They're totally confused. I mean, there's all kinds of controversies. They just hide the controversies from the public.
Could I?
Yes.
Intervene here. I saw in a magazine which you may have seen called the Clarion Call.
Oh, Clarion Call. Yeah.
So this is a few years ago. So it stated there that among astrophysicists, there are about 2,000 different theories about the origin of the universe. I wonder how many astrophysicists there are in the world. There are probably not more than 2,000. They're probably all different strains of different theories.
Yeah, the
which means they don't.
And it's interesting that the most talked about theory today is the superstring theory. Not that there's, you know, anything to it, just it's a big speculation and they admit it. But it's the one, you know, they become, like I said, it's like fashion. So, you know, now it's fashionable to be enamored with the superstring theory. And so the superstring theory posits 27 dimensions. There's 27 higher dimensions. And in these dimensions, there are strings that are vibrating. You know, like sitar strings. And they're vibrating, and their vibrations are everything we're experiencing. So why don't they just turn to the Vedas? And they're, you know, this really weird, contorted way. You know, they're coming up with these, their higher dimensions, and there is sound and some source of, you know, vibration and some source of vibration in higher dimensions. String or something. This is as far as they can get. You know, the string, like on Goddess Saraswati's Veena. And it's just a theory. But everything is so nicely. You see, this, what this is showing is that their logic and reason by itself moves in that direction. But because they will not accept the authority of the Vedas, they end up in some weird corner of, you know, painting themselves into a corner of speculation. It's all theoretical, and that means someone else is going to come along and kick it all down. But the fashion is going to change. Someone else will have a different theory, and they'll all rush to that corner. You see, but you can see that the human mind, it gravity, or there's another one. There's Alan Guth. And so his theory, it's jokingly called the truth according to Guth. And he imagines there is this great primordial ocean of virtual energy bubbling away, and out of this ocean they're coming, the universes like bubbles, they bubble up and they expand, and there's countless universes bubbling up and then going back into the ocean, bubbling up again. So why don't you just go to the Srimad Bhagavatam and learn about Mahavishnu laying in the causal ocean and breathing out the universes like bubbles, Prabhupada says, and then breathe them back in and out again. As I say, the human mind gravitates to the objective truth of the Bhagavatam. But because they won't, they dare not. You know, they're so brainwashed by this anti-authoritarian intellectualism, they dare not surrender, that's the point. And therefore they're duskritina. And therefore maya pritigyana. They have knowledge, but it's stolen by illusion.
Maybe he was even reading this
Srimad Bhagavatam. Yeah, someone like Heisenberg, Werner Heisenberg, he studied the Upanishads, and his uncertainty theory is drawn out of the Upanishads. The famous Heisenberg theory of uncertainty was inspired by this. And of course, Oppenheimer, Robert Oppenheimer, he knew Sanskrit. He quoted the Gita, the first atom bomb explosion. But again, they won't surrender. They'll like the demons, you know. Hiranyakashipu knew the Vedas, Ravana knew the Vedas. They take what they want from the Vedas and use them for their own demoniac ends. to destroy the world.
Therefore, the obvious point that comes to that is that ultimately people will not be convinced by arguments alone that purification of consciousness is required, change of consciousness.
Yeah.
And Nayam Atma, what is that? Pravachanena Labhyana Mediana.
Yes.
Ahunena Shuddha.
Two verses in the Upanishad declare this. This point, that it's not by study, it's not by speech, by talking, it's not by speculation. One has to be chosen by the Lord Himself. And that means we have to surrender to the Lord.
Can you explain about this? We are discussing about consciousness and levels of consciousness. Can you explain about these five koshas?
I'm going to do that tomorrow. Yes.
Maharaj, I find it really embarrassing that when you are describing this chakra vyuha expansion, that there are two levels of them, and you are just telling so nicely about it. And I read many times about it, but every time I listen to that and I read it, I just, my brain falls asleep. And at the end, when you were describing that this is an essential thing to understand this, you were quoting Srila Prabhupada, that this is an essential thing to understand this. To get out of this material world, I found myself really in miserable condition, so maybe you can give some advice.
Well, this is, you see, Krishna has, we find in Chaitanya Charitamrita, there are two categories of pastimes. So there is his, as we know, his internal and transcendental Nitya Lila in the spiritual world. And this, what we're speaking of now, is termed as Vyavahar Lila in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Vyavahar means in relationship with the material nature, worldly, even conventional is sometimes used as a translation for the word Vyavahar. So the point is we are in that state now. We are in this Vyavahar state. That's our condition. But the Lord has His Vyavahar Lila. So it is important for us to understand that. You know, as part of our process of getting free. Now, I explained yesterday when I was reading these verses from the sixth canto of Bhagavatam, Yuvam Tu Vishvasya Vibhu Jagat Karanam Param, that this Vyavahar Lila, its purpose is not, actually, the Lord's purpose is not to throw away the rascal Duskritina Jivas into the dark material nature and let them rot. That's not why he's doing it. This Vyavahar Lila is all for the purpose of sacrifice. The Lord is, we heard in these verses, Sarva Yagyavuk, the enjoyer of all sacrifices. And Goddess Lakshmi comes with the Lord to be the very personification of service to the Lord. So, and they are the principles. You know, in you read in Vedic philosophy about Purusha Prakriti, that is the Lord and His consort, actually. So that is actually how the material nature is really working. The Lord and His energies having a lila, so to speak, but that lila is a lila of sacrifice. That's all that this world is, really. It's just a grand sacrifice, and the Vedas describe it as such. And human life is also said to be, in Chandogya Upanishad, it is, the human body is simply a sacrifice, a yajna. Human life is meant simply for yajna. So, therefore, you see that the true description of the universe given in the Vedas is the Vishwarup. And in the Vishwarup, there are the Brahmanas at the head, the Vaishnavas, Kshatriyas on the arms, the Vaishyas, belly, Shudras. This description is given. This is all in terms of practical sacrifice, sacrificial duties. So, this is the purpose, the final cause of this Vyavahar Lila. And so in this age, the Dharma is Yajna, sacrifice, Sankirtan Yajna. And so we also have the same duty. It's the same Vedic duty, but in terms of this present age. And Srila Prabhupada envisioned coming out of this Sankirtan Yajna, also Varna Ashram Dharma, everything, the whole Vedic culture manifests. Why? What is it? Because Prabhupada said, this chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, this purifies the consciousness. That's the whole point. He says the world has become so corrupted, so filthy, so distorted because of lying propaganda. He says that in the first canto of the Bhagavatam. So that means the vibration that is being emanated by human beings is impure. And therefore everything becomes so polluted and corrupted and distorted, and therefore you have all this nonsense science being taught to children. This is how people see the world as a big accident. You know, the universe is just a big accident, a big calamitous bang, and everything kind of flew out. And here we are, and because the origin is just an accident, therefore what we do can also be an accident. Do as you like, do as you know. All this nonsense. And it's all because of contaminated sound, lying propaganda programs. So therefore the chanting of Hare Krishna used to be done in Sankirtan worldwide to cleanse the consciousness. And when consciousness becomes cleansed, then everything falls into place. We begin to see the world as it actually is. Yes, all of this. It becomes manifest in reality to us.
I can't understand it because you're in Maya.
Yes.
That's what I understood from why you know how this is.
Okay, we still have time for questions. You've never asked a question yet. What is your good name?
Murari Gupta.
Murari Gupta, very nice name.
I
understand you perfectly.
So my question is, who is the scientist? How can scientists realize the existence of the gods if they not accept purification of consciousness and shabda and shastras?
They cannot realize, no. Well, of course, anyone can realize by the grace of the Lord. He can make someone realize if he so chooses. But by themselves, like Maharaj was citing, this, they have this Grihavrata in their heart, Matirna Krishna Paratasvatova. So Grihavrata means, Vrata means vow, and Griha means house. Griha means not only house, but also means this body. Griha means this material universe. So their vow is to remain in embodied consciousness, in this material world, enjoying sense gratification. That's their inner vow, their inner determination. And then from that status, all right, we can try by, you know, by our own investigation, by, you know, consulting with another, with a group committee. We can try to understand things. We can try to understand this Bhagavatam. Yes, but we will not give up our vow of sense gratification. So therefore, they cannot realize anything. And that's why you have Indology. You have a bunch of, you know, really gross sense gratifiers who have learned Sanskrit and are trying to understand. I met, when I was on the library party in the United States, I went with, yes, with that time Ganesham Prabhu, Bhakti Tirthamaraj, to Rutgers University in New Jersey. And we met this fellow who was teaching classical religious literature from different cultures, including, he also spent some time with Indian religious literatures as well as the myths, so-called, you know, of different cultures. So we came with our books, and this fellow, you know, I mean, as soon as he were, even when I saw his, before we entered his room to see him, his office, I was just looking at the decorations on the door to his office, and I could understand this fellow's a hippie. You know, he had all this psychedelic weird stuff. And I said, oh, and I said, what? I can just imagine what this person's going to be like. And sure enough, we both entered, Maharaj, Bhaktitirtha Maharaj and myself, Ghanshyam Prabhu. We entered, and there he was. He was wearing this, you know, very disheveled kind of clothing, and he had long hair, all, you know, uncombed, and a beard. And he was glassy-eyed and, you know, crazy smile. Oh, And then, so we sat down. Bhakti Tirthamar, he was always very enthusiastic, so he was, you know, preaching to him, you know, as if he was a normal person. I was kind of like, and so we were showing the books, and he was looking at them, and then finally he said, yeah, he said, you know, the Vedas, you know, there were these Aryans who invaded India a few thousand years ago, and after they conquered, they all got together at the foot of the Himalayas, and they brewed up some psychedelic mushroom, and they started drinking it, and they got all high, and then they started speaking these mantras that were recorded as the Vedas. You know, so they're really far out scriptures, because, you know, a bunch of stone freaks spoke them. And I'm interested. What is that? Atmaman manyatejaka. One sees the world as one is. So he's, you know, himself indulging in drugs. That's how he understands the Vedas. So anyone who is, you know, who will not give up this vow that we're in this world to enjoy it, then even if they take up a study of Vedic knowledge, or, you know, through science try to understand God or whatever, they are not going to realize anything. They can theorize this or that, and accidentally, you know, by chance, some of their theories, just like here in the seminar, sometimes I'm pointing out, here's an interesting theory that quite parallels some portion of Vedic literature. But that doesn't mean I'm giving that theoretician any credit, really. You see? Just his mind happened to move in that direction, and but nothing will be realized, even from a good theory. You see? Even from a good theory. Because they refuse to engage in the process of realization, which is purification. So that just means, from that theory, they'll go to another theory, another theory, another theory, on and on, endlessly. The endless realm of mental speculation.
How did Newton realize that there is some higher
intelligence? We're not saying that Newton realized anything. He believed. A person can be pious and believe, and they have some intuition. There's what is known as intuition, or, you know, some sense somewhere. Like I told you about Kant. He was the last major European philosophy to try to defend, to try to support Christianity by philosophy. But in his philosophy, he said there's no way, he himself argued, there's no way to realize God. You can't really, you know, realize means to see directly. There's no way that that can be done. But he said you can have some sense that there must be a God because of the moral order of things, he said, like that, because it's the aspiration of human being to be good, and therefore there theoretically we can accept that there must be a supreme good. So they don't realize anything. They theorize and they hope, they may have some faith. They don't realize, not until you take to Krishna's process. Krishna gives the process in Bhagavad Gita, how to realize the absolute truth. And if we don't take Krishna's process, we won't realize.
Maharaj, well, it's clear that without purification, without purification, all the scientists and they can't accept Vedas. So, but all this, you know, for the seminar right now. So how can we actually use this information we're getting on tradition in preaching practically, except for just getting it for our own, like, you know, like strength? Or, I mean, maybe I just you know, should become a cook in the kitchen of some quantum physics institute, because how can I practically purify these people? Otherwise, you know, even if I know all this information, I can't really use it.
Well, all right, so Srila Prabhupada, he did say that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for the mass of people, his program was chanting Hare Krishna and distributing prasadam. Mm-hmm. And for very few, like Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, Prakashananda Saraswati, who are truly intellectual personalities, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is the incarnation of Brihaspati. So, with them he discussed philosophy, but not with common people. For them, there is the Sankirtan chanting and prasad distribution. That's true, but then Prabhupada also said that this movement is a brain-giving movement. They say we are brainwashing, but no. You have no brain to wash. First he said, yes, we are washing your brain because your brain is covered with stool. And then a beat later he said, actually, you have no brain. So this is not brainwashing, we are brain giving. So by this process of chanting and Nam Sankirtan, book distribution, prasad distribution, people's intelligence is becoming stimulated. And I see this practically myself. I mean, anyone who's been in the Hare Krishna movement for 20, 30 years, I joined in 1971, you know, preaching then and preaching now is a very different experience. Because people, over the years of Srila Prabhupada's expanding this movement so widely, people have become purified and they understand things and accept things a lot more readily now than they did then. And this is only increasing. We see, now people, you know, all kinds of people, even people who still eat meat, but they understand that it is more healthy to be vegetarian, it's better. It's just that they're weak or something, they can't give it up. But they're immediately willing to accept, yes, to be vegetarian is good. But I mean, back then we used to meet the militant meat eaters, you know? Especially the Christians. For them it was like a theological doctrine. I remember in Berkeley, California, we were chanting and some Christians came and we were chanting, so they were shouting something but couldn't be heard. Because we were chanting, drowning them out. But when the kirtan wound down a bit, then you could hear. They were chanting, praise the Lord and eat the cow. Praise the Lord and eat the cow. Praise the Lord and eat the cow.
Once outside our Solomon Street temple, I walked out and there was a Christian distributing pamphlets. So there was a picture of Satan. Nasty eyes, big teeth, holding a plate of carrots and cauliflower. Vegetarianism is satanic.
I haven't seen people like that for quite a number of years. They may still be around, but certainly not as prominently. And now you meet persons who are, yes, they may not be vegetarian themselves, but they admit that that's the better way of life. They understand so many things. They can grasp immediately so many transcendental concepts, which were very difficult previously. So that's why we should know this philosophy now, you see, as much as our brains can accommodate, because the quality of the people we're preaching to is getting better and better and better.
I'd like to make another point. Is that also generally the people, they have all these different philosophies and they're very puffed up and they think that they really know everything, but they meet a devotee who challenges them and they give different arguments, and then at least it starts to at least they respect the devotees, that they have something to say, even if they don't accept it. And also it can jog them out of their complacency. As Giriraj Maharaj also told one anecdote, that they went one time with Prabhupada to MIT, and then Prabhupada gave a lecture. MIT Massachusetts is like supposed to be the topmost scientific educational institution in the world, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So Prabhupada gave a lecture and the people weren't listening, they were fidgeting and this and that. So Prabhupada finished the lecture quickly and then he asked for questions and immediately so many hands shot up. And they shot out these questions. I can't remember exactly what Giriraj Maharaj told, but Prabhupada just with short one-liners shot down all their questions. And there were like 20 questions and then they all went quiet. And Giriraj Maharaj said they realized they were in the they're in the presence of a superior intelligence. So it's good to break the pride by which they think they're superior. Of course, we have to know engineers, we have to know our stuff. Don't walk into MIT if you don't know us.
Yeah, that's a good point because, you know, people, when they see a devotee, they tend to think that we're, you know, foolish, just by seeing the way, not only the way we dress, but because
nice,
devotees are
nice people.
Yeah,
not much up here.
Right, devotees just you know we're happy, you know, and this is a thing in the material world. Generally, the more if you see a person in the material world, the more carefree they look, the more happy they look usually means they're pretty silly people. You know? The more, you know, thinking a person is, the more aware he is. What is he aware of? He's aware of suffering. He's aware of problems. And therefore their brow becomes furrowed and face becomes long. They look always very preoccupied. You know, this is one very clear evidence. Of course, Prabhupada said our Matajis are different, but you know, there's this question, are men more intelligent than women? Why you say men are more intelligent than women? You just look at when you see a man and a woman together on the street. Who's smiling and who's frowning? See, generally, it's the woman, she's got a big smile on her face, and the man is... It's because he's smarter, you see. He's more aware that you know, there's problems. Problems with her, too. He's more aware of that, and it pushes him down. And the woman is just, you know, let's go shopping, dear. Let's spend your money, dear. So, I mean, devotees, you know, we appear to them like that. We're, you know, bright-faced and smiling and just moving through the world, very relaxed. And so they suspect that we must also be stupid. That's why it's good. It's very good, as Maharaj said, to speak on a lofty platform. That does shake them out of their complacency.
Maharaj, I just want to add something on that, from my own experience. Like, I've been giving this life after death seminar in an Apollo hospital, one of the best hospitals in Delhi. And, around the past 8 years, Delhi Temple, they have been trying to teach doctors and they were not quite up. They didn't take up a good time. So I presented, although I knew that they're not understanding most of their purpose. Although I also knew that we cannot explain consciousness through all these Bose condensers and all these things. But after the seminar, we distributed around 30 Bhagavad Gita's in one shot, and so many doctors took that. Yes, okay, this is. So something is there. They know that side also and this side also, so they accept it.
Because you were presenting it, what, with showing scientific theories and this and that?
Yeah, all these theories and multimedia. And they themselves didn't know what is happening around the scientific world. Although they could understand, but they knew that whatever we are speaking, we know this stuff also, and we know the fallacies also.
Yes.
And then they accepted.
Yes.
Rasaraj Prabhu told me, was once lecturing at, I think it was IIT Kanpur, and then Rasaraj Prabhu was one of our big scientific genii. I guess there are two. I don't make a joke. Anyway, he spoke, I don't exactly the subject, I don't remember, and then someone said that, oh, whatever you say is being disproved by string theory. And then Rasaraj called his bluff. He said, do you know what string theory is? And then if man tried to explain it a bit, and then Rasaraja explained it much better than he did, and showed that how his idea of what, how string theory disproved what he said didn't disprove it at all. So, unfortunately, there are not that many people in the world today who take much interest in philosophy at all. Because science, like this, you're saying science, they think, well, we don't need it, we're just practical, we don't need philosophy. Can I say something? I mean, there are so many interesting things you're jerking up in our brains that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he wrote and spoke in a level of Bengali that very few people could understand. So you might think, well, why did he do that at all, that people can't understand? Because he was, the intellectuals at the time thought that learning means Western scholasticism. So he showed that you may not understand, but you have to appreciate that this is on a higher level, and it's if you want to come, you have to come up to our level. Pulling up the level of scholasticism, himself setting the level.
Would you explain about
so it will be good if the people of the world can appreciate this. That we, there should be many Sahotra Swamis who go around and preach all these things and think, oh, well, they're outdone by you all. Even these university professors, I mean, they don't know it like you're saying, and they don't know so much actually. They have a very limited field of knowledge, and they people are they're awed by the PhD, MSc, this, that, and often they don't know very much.
Yeah, this is something that should be mentioned, that this expansion of knowledge, so-called, is really just the further divisions of specialized, departments of knowledge. And they branch out. They branch out, become more specialized and more specialized. So intelligent people today who get in these fields, their spectrum of what's going on in the world, in the universe, is actually becoming more and more narrow. You know, like these quantum physicists, they're studying subatomic particles, the most small, narrow thing, and they're, from this, they're, speculating universal principles. But actually, they've lost touch with reality, and this is happening on so many fronts of knowledge. So, if a devotee can present a broad spectrum. And yes, this is the nature of Bhagavata knowledge, the broadest spectrum, all inclusive. Then I've seen this in my own university preaching, that this really interests people, because that narrowing knowledge, it just becomes drier and drier and drier, because it becomes less and less related to anything else. So it becomes pure theory, hardly any, just a few thin filaments of connection to practical existence, and therefore very, very dry. So when one can wrap it up, bring the whole, cosmoptic, seeing everything as a cosmic totality, everything functioning within a total system, as described in the Vedas, they find that very, very interesting.
And also that you give so many examples from various fields of learning,
yes,
and various philosophers. It also impresses people that you're not just dogmatically stuck in one box, but you've seen everything, and you come to this conclusion.
Yes.
So that's also very attractive for preaching, that people don't think that we're just dogmatic preachers.
Right.
In a world in which people don't accept Vedic knowledge as being axiomatic truth. Prabhupada himself stated that people don't accept the Vedas, therefore we have to present in terms of logic and
Maharaj explained about how the jiva came down from impersonal level to the brahmana level, devotee level to yogi level, then to so if the jiva can come from the devotee level to the lower levels, so is it true for one who attained, one who went back home to the Godhead? Because we normally say Krishna promised that one who has come back to the spiritual world will never come down.
Mm.
But this explanation apparently seems like even at that level he can, by his feeling, willing and thinking, can come down.
In this, I was citing Brahman and Vaishnava by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And in that very section, I was telling you about, he speaks of taste as being the supremely guiding factor in this, whether a impersonally realized brahmana will go up or a devotee will go down. This is all a matter of the taste that one is developing in one's activities. So, when one returns to the spiritual world, one has had a taste of the material world. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada said, one will not go back. One can go back. You see, because free will is never negated. It's not, and this is the thing I was referring the other day, how material consciousness is this automatic consciousness. You know, you just consign your willpower to something else, which takes command of you. And you let it take you away. But this is not Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is Krishna consciousness, being conscious of Krishna. Consciousness is the means of relationship to Krishna. You understand? It's our consciousness meeting with Krishna consciousness. So, one should not, we have to rid ourselves of this idea that when we go back to the spiritual world, then we're going to be in some sort of automatic safe position in which perhaps our free will has been taken away from us, you know, has been shut down, disconnected somehow or other. And then we can just, you know, go on. No, it is, one remains in the spiritual world by one's consciousness, by what one does with one's consciousness. You see. So the thing, what Prabhupada explained, as I've heard from senior godbrothers who have discussed these things with Sri Prabhupada, and as much as I've read in the recorded statements of Prabhupada, what Prabhupada was explaining was that one doesn't come back not because one no longer has the will to come back, but one doesn't come back out of desire, because one is, you know, one is, has experienced the lower taste and knows what it is and has fully rejected it.
That would appear to put those who come to the material world and come back in a better position than those who haven't come. Less risk is.
No, we learn that the, hearing from Baladeva Vibhushan, that the liberated soul, the one who is in full Krishna consciousness, he knows everything about the material world too. So the living entities who come here have made a mistake. They have become inattentive. That is what is focused on, that they have become inattentive. They have their consciousness has somehow become removed from Krishna. And thus they find the material world attractive. So, there's this, like Prabhupada said, there's First-class intelligence, one understands things just by hearing. Second-class intelligence, one has to learn by experience also. One hears but can't quite get it. And so one has to learn by experience. And then one can be first-class after that. You had another question? I thought you said you had two questions.
No, I have two questions. One question was answered by you explaining this Pratishtha Sarva Purpos Leela also. But the second question is just asking.
Okay.
Yes. Sorry, my English is very bad. I can ask in Croatian and maybe somebody can explain.
Okay.
ako se starta u proces pročišćenja, ako se krene u proces pročišćenja, može shvatiti cijela ova znanost o...
Maharaj told that only when one start to practice, go to process of purification, and then we can understand.
I kako u stvari osoba starta, da li to stvar neke, da dobije tu preliminarno jel, da li to stvar potrebno milosti gospodina, ipak neke zasluge.
So Mataji is asking how one starts, whether this is mercy of Lord, or if there is some dequalification, or... that kind of preliminary faith, how it actually comes.
Well, ultimately it is by association. And association comes by mercy. But still there's the question of how we respond to that opportunity of association. But the Lord is so kind, He'll even trick us, or the Lord's devotee. Therefore there's this agyata sukriti. You understand, huh? Okay, I can just... So agyata sukriti means that one gets an unknowing opportunity to render service to a saintly person or to observe Ekadasi, for example, without knowing what Ekadasi is. So these opportunities are also built into the creation, so to speak. These are hidden, it's like in a game, you know, I suppose. And you turn over a card and you've won something. You know? So these are hidden chances for the living entity to make spiritual progress or begin his spiritual life. But still, our will remains the deciding factor in all of this. We get opportunities, but we can spoil the opportunity too by misuse of free will.
Yes. So regarding this agyata sukriti, in a very sorry for this conversation, when the discussion was going on, that this agyata sukriti is by chance, and then Prabhupada said that it is desire of the Lord. Ultimately, Lord is a person, so he can desire to give anybody a chance.
Yeah.
So ultimately, it concludes to the desire of the Lord whom he wants to pick up.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Just like once I heard from Solanas Bhaktivinoda Bharat, like somebody is doing welfare work, and somebody has planted a tree some millions of years ago, and sometime some devotee is going and he takes rest there, then the Lord recognizes his pious activity and he may proceed.
Yes.
The person who planted the tree, he just wanted to get some punya for going to Swarga Loka. So he recommends plant trees on the side of the road. And then the devotee comes and he also takes shade in the tree. So the person, he may be in Swarga, but he's getting some. Therefore, the body is moving the world to help people somehow or other at some stage come to Krishna consciousness.
Prabhupada said that building in Detroit, which is now called Devasadan Mandir, he said it was built for us, it was built for Krishna. But those who built it didn't know that. But you can even see, the temple room is amazing because there's this natural three arched stage, perfect for three sets of deities. So that was apparently built as a band standard. There was the original idea, have a dance band or something playing there. But nothing had to be changed. Just put the deities there. And it's beautiful. They didn't change any of the painting or the same design. It's perfect for temples. So Prabhupada made that comment. So yes, how this is arranged, this ultimately the Lord is behind it all.
Wait, I have one question. Yesterday I was making a point that when a stone is put in the center of the point, like that, the ripples, right? It keeps expanding. So holy name, when we chant, so it keeps on, like when a devotee chants, like we do Harinam Sankirtan here, does this holy name expand all over the world? Or
yes, all over the universe and into the spiritual world. When you chant Hare Krishna, the residents of Goloka Vrindavan are rejoicing that Krishna's glories are being sung in that dark city of Salem or wherever. You're from Udupi, huh? Well, Udupi is not a dark place. But, you know, say London or New York or some place like that. So the residents of the spiritual world are rejoicing that even Krishna is being glorified there. So the sound vibration pervades everything.
So by that way, so many non-devotees are there, their consciousness gets purified, and they, like you are making a point that now at least people are ready to accept vegetarianism. Earlier, yes,
yeah.
That was very hopeless. So that means
yes. Yes. Everything rests, you see, on consciousness and this vibration. Ultimately, it's vibration of thought. Sound is also, this is also the philosophy of the Vedas, the four levels of sound, which are related to this same, what I'm explaining. Chaturvyuha, four stages of creation. So there are also four levels of sound, starting with para, paravak. And so in this way, so the ultimate level of sound is purely spiritual. This is the movements of pure consciousness. And then there's the movements of intelligence, paśyantiva, and then the movement of mind, and then finally what we speak. You see? So, when we chant Hare Krishna, that Maha Mantra is pervading all these levels of consciousness. So even, that means, even without someone hearing it with their ears on that level, the vibration is coming on the mental level and the intellectual level and spiritual level. So the purifying effect of this Nam Sankirtan movement, it's not just what we see, you know, on the level of pratyaksha, but it has a whole, that's only one quarter of what's going on. Three quarters metaphysical is there, and we don't perceive that so easily, but it's there, and that's why the world is changing. We're entering a golden age, aren't we? That's what we understand. Brahmananda Purana, there are some verses in which this is told, golden age within the Kali Yuga. It's 12:30. We stop. Save your questions for tomorrow.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Shri Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai.
Jai.